This is Ed Livingston, Deputy Editor of Clinical Reviews and Education for JAMA, with today's JAMA Evidence Podcast. So I'm very honored to speak today with Gordon Guyatt, the Principal Editor of the User's Guide to the Medical Literature, to discuss Chapter 8, How to Use a Non-Inferiority Trial. I think this is a critically important chapter because I think many clinicians get confused by these concepts, and I know I certainly did. So let me start, Gord, by asking you about what you're testing when you test an equivalence trial.
Well, equivalence trial, as opposed to non-inferiority, tries to establish that there is really no difference between an intervention and a control. And that is very challenging because defining no difference is very difficult. And basically, equivalence trials have more or less gone out of fashion and essentially been replaced by non-inferiority. Non-inferiority does not try to establish equivalence, but rather says, if the new treatment is not as good as the old treatment with respect to the primary outcome, is the difference small enough that it is still acceptable?
The concept of non-inferiority is very complicated because of the terminology. There's a lot of double negatives, and it's very, very hard to follow. As a clinician, what I really want to know is if new drug B is the same as the old drug A. So why is it so difficult to not just compare things along those lines?
Well, because in equivalence trials, you are trying to establish both boundaries. So let's say you have two treatments, A and B. And if it favors A, you're saying it's plus 1%. And if it favors B, it's minus 1%. And you say, okay, I'm ready to interpret equivalence if it's between plus 1% and minus 1%. Well, that forces you to show that it's really in an extremely narrow range on both sides. The non-inferiority is easier because it just says, are we on one side of the minus 1%? It could be plus 2% or plus 3%, but are we on just on one side of the minus 1%? So it's the difference between, in a conventional superiority trial, we just are saying, okay, can we say that we're above zero effect? Simply the difference with non-inferiority, are we above an effect of minus 1 or minus 2 or whatever? We don't have both boundaries. The equivalence trial makes it more difficult because you're setting two different boundaries and saying that the effect is between those two boundaries.
So that implies a directionality for non-inferiority. So you're looking at one side. So could you explain to me, when comparing a new treatment to a standard treatment, one, I guess, is on the left side of the minus sign, the other one's on the right, so the boundary is a negative one. Could you explain some of that?
Sure. So typically, traditionally, a new treatment was supposed to be better than existing treatment with what one might call the primary endpoint or endpoints. So we're trying to prevent stroke, we're trying to prevent heart attacks, and we want to make sure that we do, in fact, prevent them. The new treatment often is more costly. It often has adverse effects, but we're ready to tolerate that if the effect of the new treatment is sufficiently better than the old one. With non-inferiority, what the new treatment has to offer is not that it is better with respect to primary endpoints like reducing stroke or myocardial infarction or even mortality, but rather it has other advantages. Those other advantages may be decreased burden, so you don't have to be as careful. Anticoagulants is a great example. You don't have the INR monitoring of warfarin. You don't have to be worried about drug interactions quite as much. Don't have to be worried about your alcohol quite as much. So that's one advantage, a burden advantage. And the other advantage can be a toxicity advantage. So we're saying, okay, the advantages of this new drug are not that it's better in reducing stroke or myocardial infarction, but that it has burden or toxicity. And then we say, if those burden or toxicity advantages are sufficiently great, we are ready to accept that the treatment may not be quite as good in reducing what it's supposed to do primarily, which is reducing stroke or myocardial infarction. So with the burden and toxicity advantages, we're ready to accept a small, or perhaps not so small, if the burden and toxicity advantages are very large, increase in strokes and myocardial infarctions. In other words, that the new treatment is less effective with respect to the primary endpoint than what exists currently.
So that difference is the non-inferiority margin. And that margin is basically saying that one treatment is just as good as another treatment. But how do you go about determining what that margin should be?
Well, I can tell you when you say how it is determined, I can tell you how we think it should be determined. We think that clinicians should consider the benefits in terms of toxicity and burden and say, what do we think that our patients are willing to accept? So it's really a value judgment. The novel anticoagulants are a great example to illustrate this, I think. So traditional treatments are warfarin, major disadvantages, and you have to have your INR checked all the time. You have to be very worried about drug interactions, and the novel anticoagulants do not have those problems. So what the clinician should ask is, in thinking in a non-inferiority frame of mind, how much, say it's in atrial fibrillation, you're mainly worried about stroke, how much of an increase in stroke relative to warfarin would my patients be willing to accept for the advantages of getting away from all the burdens associated with warfarin? And like any time when there's benefits and downsides of treatments, which there almost always is, it's a value and preference judgment. And when you think about it then, how would we make that? Well, the greater the burden and toxicity advantages, or less burden, less toxicity advantages of the new drug, the more we're willing to accept a decrement in benefit. So big burden and toxicity advantages, we're ready to accept a little more loss of benefit in an outcome like stroke or myocardial infarction. It also then depends on what we are losing. So we might not want to lose very much if it were death, that we're losing benefits, we're going to have more deaths. We might not be willing to lose very much if it was stroke or particularly severe stroke, maybe more with myocardial infarction, or maybe if it was just hospital admission, we might be willing to lose more. So it's a trade-off that essentially involves values and preferences. But there may be a number of reasons, that's not how the Food and Drug Administration wants to do it. The Food and Drug Administration, in a way, a much more complicated statistical approach, which says, okay, what was the effect of a meta-analysis, what was the benefit of the previous accepted treatment, and we are willing to give up half of the benefit of the previously accepted treatment. That's how we set our non-inferiority margin. That, and in doing so, they ignore the issues of how much toxicity and burden benefit you're getting with the new treatment, and they ignore what the outcome is. So we don't think that's terribly satisfactory, and what the clinician might want to know how the FDA does it, but what the clinician should think about is, what are the values and preferences of my patient given the burden and toxicity benefits of the new treatment? How much would my patients be willing to give up in terms of the benefits in reducing death, stroke, myocardial infarction, or whatever it is?
So how do you recommend that a clinician interpret a negative non-inferiority trial? And the reason I ask is we've published a couple of papers in the last year at the journal wherein the investigators took a guess at what they thought the non-inferiority margin should be for a particular intervention. And then when they did the trials, they missed the margin by just a little bit. So because they had predefined that margin, they had to conclude that they were not able to demonstrate non-inferiority, yet there were very substantial statistically significant effects of the interventions. Given that the non-inferiority margin is established somewhat subjectively, how do you think the practicing doctor should interpret this sort of thing when they see those kinds of conclusions in a journal article?
Well, the issue is whether non-inferiority has been established or non-established, do you accept the non-inferiority margin? So one example we use in the paper, in the user's guide, is a trial that looked at a new way of treating endometrial carcinoma, and the new treatment had fewer gastrointestinal effects. And the investigators said, for this reduction in gastrointestinal effects, we think patients would be, or we set our non-inferiority, they don't frame it in what patients think, although we believe they should, we set our non-inferiority margin at a 6% increase in the recurrence of the carcinoma. And the clinician would have to say, are my patients ready to accept that? Well, they met their criteria. The boundary of the confidence interval said, well, it could be as much as a 5% increase. When we presented that to clinicians, they think patients would not be ready to accept a 5% increase in recurrence for the decreased GI toxicity with the new treatment. So that is the question that clinicians should ask themselves. If they miss the non-inferiority margin, in other words, they say, okay, we think we set our non-inferiority margin at 3%, and it turns out that the treatment may be as much as 4% worse, clinician has to say, well, with my patients, if there were 4% more strokes or myocardial infarctions or recurrences of carcinoma or whatever, would my patients be willing to accept that for the toxicity and burden advantages of the treatment?
That is a really great explanation. Thank you for that, Gord. That really puts it into perspective, because we struggled with this on a couple of papers this year.
If you think about what your patients are trading off, I'm delighted that you like the explanation, because we think that, that's the way to frame it is to think of what our patients would be willing to accept.
We published this major randomized controlled trial of antibiotic treatment for appendicitis. The investigators picked a non-inferiority margin of 24%. They really didn't have any basis for that. They just picked it because that was the best they could do, because there's no trial evidence to guide them. So they picked it, and it turned out that the margin was like 26%. So it was technically a negative trial and had to be presented as such, but roughly three-quarters of all patients who were enrolled in the trial never needed surgery. And so unfortunately, the trial was perceived by the surgical community as negative because we said it was negative, but three-quarters of patients didn't need surgery, and I think that's a pretty big thing. So my recommendation to people was you need to look at the actual numbers and forget about this.
Absolutely.
Rigid.
As a matter of fact, so there was a situation where you would have said their non-inferiority margin was perhaps too conservative. Fortunately, in most situations, it's in the other direction. People are ready to accept, to conclude non-inferiority when patients might not be inclined to accept it. But your point is absolutely right. Either way, look at it, think of what it means in terms of the benefits and downsides, and how your patients would feel about it.
Yeah, so the bottom line is it requires some subjectivity and common sense in interpreting these journal articles, irrespective of what we say.
Yes, absolutely, as in fact, every journal article requires that when it involves trade-offs between benefits and downsides, which with virtually every treatment we have, it does involve trade-offs between benefits and downsides.
Great. Well, let me see if you can help me with another concept I've struggled with. And this relates to intention to treat and how it factors into non-inferiority. And I'm going to start with intention to treat by itself. So again, as a clinician, maybe not a sophisticated trialist or epidemiologist, I would look at intention to treat studies when I was practicing surgery and think, who really cares about that? I don't really care that they were randomized to an operation or medicine, and they may have crossed over, and you know, maybe they were randomized to medicine and they got surgery and they had a good outcome. I really only want to know the effect of the surgery. And so I had troubles as a clinician buying into the concept of intent to treat. I really was interested in a per protocol analysis. I wanted to know how the intervention actually worked. How do you explain that to clinicians?
Well, the disadvantage of podcasts is I don't get to teach with a whiteboard, which makes it a bit more challenging. But the concept is that the purpose of randomization is to create groups that are prognostically balanced. And that's why we bother with randomized trials. That's why we don't just do observational studies and see people who happen to have gotten the treatment who didn't, because we're worried about prognostic imbalance. As soon as you start taking people out who were randomized, you risk losing the prognostic balance that randomization created in the first place. So if you take out the people who didn't take their treatment, you are removing people that, unless they are prognostically identical to those who remain who did take their treatment, you're going to bias the results. If the people who didn't take treatment were, in fact, prognostically worse, they were the people destined to do badly, which, as it turns out, they usually are, then you're going to get rid of the prognostically bad people from the treatment group and make the treatment look better. Even if there's no effect at all, you're going to make treatment look good simply by getting rid of the prognostically poor people, people who are destined to do badly, and you get a misleading result. In other words, you throw away. You went to all the trouble to do a randomized trial. Why? To create prognostic balance. And now you throw away what the intent was when you randomized. You basically take it back to an observational study by throwing out people who are likely to have a different prognosis. So the reason for the intention to treat is to maintain the prognostic balance that randomization created in the first place.
So that really helps me understand it. It makes a tremendous amount of sense. So you convince me that intention to treat is the right way to look at a clinical trial. Why is it not necessarily the right way to look at a non-inferiority trial?
Well, it is and it isn't. So the downside of intention to treat is that it will underestimate the effects if everybody took the treatment. So you're right, we're interested in the physicians and patients we think are interested, what happens if I take the treatment. But unfortunately, if we just look at those people as I just described, it throws away the balance that that randomization created in the first place. So intention to treat is not a perfect solution in that it really doesn't tell us what we're interested in. It does give us an unbiased result. But part of the reason I think we're relatively comfortable with that is it's a conservative conclusion. So if a trial, some of the people don't take the treatment and the treatment still looks good, we're pretty comfortable because we think if everybody'd take the treatment, if anything, the treatment would look even better. So it gives us a conservative conclusion. And I think that's part of why in conventional superiority trials, we're comfortable with the intention to treat. In the non-inferiority, picture what would happen if a large proportion of the people did not take the conventional treatment, the standard treatment. Well, now you're losing all the benefits of the standard treatment, and it'll be very easy to show non-inferiority. Now we have an anti-conservative situation with the intention to treat. We risk saying, okay, we can adopt this new treatment. It's no worse than the existing treatment or only a small amount worse, when in fact it would be a lot worse if people only took the standard treatment. So people, I think, are less comfortable with intention to treat, even though it maintains prognostic balance, gives us an unbiased assessment, but it is anti-conservative in contrast to the standard superiority trial. And that's why people like to say, not that the protocol may be biased, but because of the anti-conservative nature of intention to treat in the context of non-inferiority, if we conclude non-inferiority, we'd like also to look at a per protocol to feel safer that the protocol supports the intention to treat.
This is Ed Livingston, Deputy Editor for Clinical Reviews and Education of JAMA. You've just heard the most recent JAMA Evidence podcast on non-inferiority trials. This is a very complicated topic and not necessarily easy to follow. I encourage our listeners to look at the June 16, 2015 issue of JAMA, where there is a JAMA Guide to Statistics and Methods summary of non-inferiority trials written by Drs. Amy Cagey and Roger Lewis. This article is written for practicing clinicians who don't have a statistical background and provides an easier way for clinicians to understand these concepts, which are not at all intuitive. Thank you for listening. Make sure to go to the iTunes Store or Stitcher and subscribe to the JAMA Clinical Reviews podcasts. These are informative podcasts that cover clinical topics that provide in-depth coverage of clinical topics. We encourage you to write reviews of these podcasts so that we get feedback and can make them even better.